row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch and row by row, someone blessed these seeds I sowed. Someone warmed them from below till the rains come and tumble them down.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a production of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. We are Teresa Golden and Jean Thomas, Master Gardener volunteers. We discuss gardening issues seasonally and describe the events and educational services we provide. The seasoning segments appear on a timely basis, according to what's happening in our gardens during the year. Outstanding in their field segments are an opportunity to introduce our most outstanding volunteers individually. Cross-pollinating stories will discuss the activities of master gardeners in additional roles. We have master foresters and master naturalists included in our membership, as well as master beekeepers. We even have brewmasters. There are other offerings available from Cooperative Extension, and we will periodically be chatting with representatives of the busy 4-H program and the Taste of New York market, as well as the various offerings for assistance with family life, from child care to budget planning. From time to time, we will go live for a call-in show when a particularly urgent topic arises. The podcast of Digging In with Master Gardeners is available through this station and via a link on our own website at ccecolumbiagreen.org/gardening.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. Thank you for joining us. I'm Tim Kennelty, Master Gardener Volunteer with Cornell Cooperative Extension, and I'm joined by Jean Thomas and Teresa Golden, two of our Master Gardener Volunteers. In this segment, we'll be talking about harvesting the garden, which is a very timely topic for this time of year. In our second half hour, stay tuned for a discussion about preserving the harvest, which I'm sure you will find to be very interesting. So let's dig in. So Jean and Teresa, let's talk about when and how to harvest your vegetables and a bit about how to extend the gardening season. Growing your food can be very satisfying. It pays off in a number of ways. Your fruits and vegetables are fresher. You can choose the exact varieties that you and your family enjoy. Plus, you can potentially save money when compared with purchasing vegetables at the grocery store or farmer's market. At Cornell Cooperative Extension, we can provide resources and advice to help you start small and gradually move up to producing more of your family's food. So how do you know when your veggies are ready?
Well, vegetables are sometimes like Goldilocks, where sometimes you need to pick them early, sometimes you need to pick them late, and sometimes they're just right. So it really does vary, and you need to listen to the plant and also listen to the fruit. An example might be that strawberries really need to be picked when they're ready. Tomatoes can be picked early. You don't want tomatoes to be on the vine too long, nor do you want strawberries to be on the vine too long, because then the critters are going to go after them. So it does really vary. Sometimes the plant will tell you itself, like when the bottom leaves of the garlic start to turn brown, you know they're ready to go. What you're really trying to do when you pick vegetables is prevent the signal within the plant that says their job is done and they stop producing. By picking the vegetable, what you're doing is saying, oh, I need to make more seed, let me make more fruit. And by picking at the right time, what happens is you end up getting a higher yield.
And besides outsmarting the plant, if you're aware that they all fall into one of maybe three major families, you can go accordingly. Squash, cucumbers, pumpkins are all the same family. Cabbages, Brussels sprout, broccoli, all the same family, similar treatment. And the tomatoes, the peppers, and eggplant are all related, so they require similar conditions. And their ripeness is similar, that they cue you at the same kind of timing. And once you've learned one, you've pretty well set up to learn the other ones. One of the things that's the most useful time-saving thing is to read the seed packet. If you put in plants, go look up a seed packet, because that gives you all your timing instructions. It tells you way more than you expect. So read the seed packet. That'll give you a good direction, even for harvest as well as for growing the crop.
That makes a lot of sense. I just got some delicious pole beans from my neighbor. What about beans?
Oh, beans are wonderful. They're all in the same family. And there are basically two types of beans. They're the pole beans that you harvest when the little bean inside is about quarter full size. The green beans, the yellow beans that the old timers call wax beans, those are all the ones that you make up in the salads and casseroles all summer long. And they are ready to pick. Some of them are scheduled by hybridizing to pick the entire plant worth at a time, so you can actually calculate that. One of the other good ways to go with those beans is to plant on a two-week succession. So when your first crop is harvested, you can just pick off the whole bunch, and then you have another batch coming along right behind them. So that's one of the ways to outsmart them, and it also extends your harvest season. The other kind of beans are the ones that you're growing for the seeds. The fava beans, the lima beans, the pinto beans, all the ones that you cook up and you wait for the seed to harvest within the shell. And those, in fact, as far as preservation, require a whole different system. You don't eat those off the vine. You have to preserve those or store them. They can be stored dry. There's different methods of preparing them. But beans, there are a lot of beans that are grown for ornamental value. Scarlet Runner bean is absolutely gorgeous, and it's edible, both as the seed and as the pod. So beans are a way fun adventure.
It's almost like we could do a whole program on beans.
Yeah.
Another key thing, though, especially for the beans that you're picking for the bean, as the actual, not the seed inside, but the actual bean plant, you need to pick them every 2 to 3 days, mm-hmm. because it's amazing how quickly they grow. But you have to be real careful that you only pick them when the vines are completely dry. If you pick them when they're wet, what you can get is bean rust, and that can also spread other diseases as well. So if you want to avoid that, make sure you pick them only when they're dry.
What about cucumbers? I know I've grown cucumbers, and if they get too big, they're really not very tasty. What about cucumbers?
Well, the key to avoid that is to make sure you pick the cucumbers before they turn yellow. Cucumbers are a native of India, so they've been cultivated for more than 3,000 years. There's two major types. There's slicing pickles and there's pickling pickles. If you see burpless cucumbers, what they really mean is that they're thin and a more tender skin and a milder flavor. There's both bush or vining cucumbers. The vining ones obviously require trellising. And you can harvest them in almost any stage of development, but the key is to pick them before they turn yellow, because then they're definitely too ripe. The slicing pickles are best picked around 5 inches long, while the pickling cucumbers, it's usually however big you want them, but it's typically less than about 2 inches long. By picking them also 2 to 3 times a week, you'll get the maximum quantity, maximum yield, and you can also make sure that the seeds don't get too big, because they're a lot crisper when you pick them earlier.
And do you have a favorite type of cucumber, Teresa?
My husband and I both like the Kirby's, because we find that they're really crisp, and there's nothing like a fresh cucumber versus what you get in the middle of the winter.
I grew up on a truck farm. I like straight eights because that's what the professionals grow. And they're the nice, big, full-size cucumbers that you could just sit down with a salt shaker, wipe the pickle off the top, and just eat them skin and all with a little bit of salt.
See, we have some diversity because I used to grow these Japanese long cucumbers, which were just delicious. I haven't grown them recently, but they're, I think, the burpless variety, I think. Okay. Yeah. I've always had trouble growing melons. What's the secret to growing good melons?
Luck. Spending money.
I think I needed some then.
Yeah, that's what you were short of. Melons have a really rigid water requirements. They need a lot of water early on to build that plant. So this year, they had lots of water early on, but it was so early and so long a period that you couldn't get planted into the ground in time to take advantage of that. Melons need to be planted when the soil is warm enough. So it was wet, but it was still cold. So this year was not a good year for them. If you've got a year when you've got nice warm soil and then lots of rain after you've planted, then you've got happy melons. Once they've started setting fruit, decrease the amount of watering. Let the plant focus on building the sugars and everything in that melon. And then you've got a chance. Around here, we've got fairly short seasons. So go for the smaller melons. If you've ever gone to the track, you've met the hand melon, which is a very famous cantaloupe that's grown up there in Saratoga County, and it's phenomenal. And they every year have success, but I think they work a little harder at it than we would in our gardens. So the harvesting of the melons, if you get that far, is also tricky. You harvest when the stem separates easily at the point of attachment. And of course, there's some cultivars that don't do that, but mostly that's your rule of thumb. The fruit should show the changes in color and the degree of the rough skin and the softening at the blossom end. So I'm sure if you're growing them, you're out there every day saying, are they ready, are they ready, are they ready? That webbing, that netting is harsher, and you can actually physically feel a difference. Once you've harvested them, the best eating is the first 1 to 3 days, and the best flavor is if the melons are stored at 70 degrees for the final ripening. Then you can chill them before serving. So there's a couple of little tricks for the successful melon garden.
So you don't smell the melons like you do in the supermarket?
I do. I smell their belly buttons.
But that's probably a place we don't want to go.
No, we don't want to go there. Then we get into watermelons.
Are watermelons the same, or are they different
requirements?
Well, they're
hard to smell their belly buttons. The same treatment, yes. Again, this is my family model. They're related to any other melon. When you've got your watermelon, you have to bear in mind that for every melon, you probably need about 20 square foot of space. So don't casually plant a melon expecting it to be fitting into your tidy garden plot. At the beginning of the season, they want 1 inch of water a week once they're planted and started to grow. They do recommend that you fertilize them when the vines begin to run and at the first fruit set. If you're serious about doing this, this is what you got to do. There are a lot of the ones that you can grow now that are smaller. They're more like the size of, say, a soccer ball. And those, you're going to get a lot more success. My granddaughter has grown them 3 seasons in a row, I'll have you know. Now, to know when to harvest, the tendrils are going to turn brown and dry. The color of the fruit itself fades back. It's not as bright, not as fresh looking. The skin is resistant to thumbnail penetration. When they're still on the green side, for lack of a better word, those skins are still too thin, and you can just stick your thumbnail through them. And another visual clue, the rind on the underside of the melon lightens up. It'll go to a pale yellow, and that's another clue. And for me, like in the supermarket, I go by the heft. If it feels like right, it's full, then to my mind, it's ready. And that's kind of all there is to watermelons.
But because the vine for both watermelons and melons are so vigorous and they require so much space, sometimes it's just easier to buy them in the supermarket or the farmer's market.
Oh, I can't believe you're saying that, she Teresa, said it on a gardening show. Well, I just bought a spiralizer because I'm obsessed with zucchini noodles. So tell me about summer squash and winter squash, because I'm going to plant some summer squash next year, I think, for my spiralizer. Tell me about summer and winter squash.
Okay, spiralizer. Okay. Summer squash is one step from cucumbers as far as the thickness of the skin. Summer squash is zucchini and yellow squash mostly. There are a couple others, but they're more variations on those anyway. Once they start coming in at maybe a 6-inch sized fruit, start harvesting and do not go away for a weekend. Because they have a really good trick at hiding until they're baseball bat size under those nice
So no big, vacation with squash.
No
at
vacation,
all.
Okay. No. And there I can teach you later some methods, because these are confidential, of how to sneak over to the neighbors with your basket of extra zucchini. That's later. On the winter squash, they have a much longer time frame that they need to ripen. But the beauty of that is that you don't have to fuss with them and harvest them and store them and do anything until just about everything else is finished. They store beautifully because you keep them on the plant until their shells are actually hard. You can tap on them. They're not soft like the zucchini and the yellow squash would be. There's all kinds of exotic shapes and sizes on the winter squash, and they're fabulous for soups and stews and cooking them up in cubes and freezing them to put into the stews later on in the winter. They will store well into the winter in a cool, dry place. They have a lot of benefits going on, but that's the main difference between the two. That the zucchini, the summer squash is closer to a cucumber, and the winter squash is better for winter.
But summer squash flowers are also edible, mm-hmm. and they're also good in salads. You can fry them, sauté them. You know, there's a variety of ways you can use the flowers, which are great. For both squashes, especially the summer squash, one more time, regular picking. So every 2 to 3 days, make sure you go out to check. Otherwise, you'll get those baseball bats. And if you get those big zucchinis, what the plant is saying is, I'm done. I don't need to produce anymore. So if you want to keep the production and the yield up of the crop, again, pick often.
So have you been making a lot of zucchini bread, Teresa? Yes, is that what you're telling us?
I made a lot, except then I got hit with the dreaded squash borer. And all of a sudden my plants started to wilt. So it's
maybe
comes
it's time.
With the territory.
Maybe it's just time.
Yes.
Yeah?
Sometimes
timing
it's
everything.
Good news, bad news.
Right.
So Jean, you were talking about the brassica family, all those kind of cold weather cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, the ones that are really good to eat in the winter. Tell us about those.
Well, I don't grow them because of that, so that's Teresa's field.
Teresa,
she loves them.
Yeah, I really like the brassica family, whether it be cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, or Brussels sprouts. And they're all a little bit different relative to when you harvest them. If cabbage, you have to harvest the head when they're firm before it splits, and that's always tricky to do it just in time. You remove the loose outer leaves, cut the stem in the ground, and you may see some smaller heads start to develop that can also be used. The key with cabbage, though, is to make sure that it gets really good soil and lots of water to be successful. Otherwise, it can be a little bit picky. Cauliflower is also a member of the family. It's ready when the cauliflower head is firm and heavy, before the curd starts to separate or become what they call ricey. If you find that the head is soft or the leaves starting to turn yellow, it's too late already. But when the heads are about only 2 to 3 inches of diameter, the trick is to take some of the leaves of the plant, cover the head to stop the head from turning yellow. And when about 1 to 3 weeks later, you're going to see the head grow to about 6 to 7 inches in diameter, and then you'll be ready to harvest. Broccoli is a fairly prolific plant. I'm actually very pleased with how easy it is to grow broccoli and how productive it is. You get the head when it's about 5 to 10 inches across, and you cut it about 6 to 7 inches below the head. And depending upon the variety that you get, you'll also see some side sprouts start to shoot up, and those are also delicious to use. So broccoli can produce well into the fall. And it'll even tolerate a light frost. So, again, a great plant to grow. Brussels sprouts, another member of the family, can also handle a light frost. And many people feel that they're actually a little sweeter if they've been exposed to a bit of a frost. You pick the sprouts at the base when the sprouts at the base of the plant are firm, about an inch and a half in diameter. Don't strip the leaves off because they're needed for growth. And you can also pinch out the growing stem at the top to get larger sprouts. But again, all members of this family are, I find, delicious.
I know we're talking about picking, but Brussels sprouts, they take really sandy soil, or is that something that you can grow around here?
I've grown them around here, and my soil's not super sandy.
Okay.
It's partly loamy.
I have a question on broccoli, harvesting broccoli. All those little wormies.
Well, I avoid those. I get rid of those if there's worms in there.
Is there a method you use?
Well, what you can do, both cauliflower and broccoli, you can put them both in salt water.
Cold salt water.
Cold salt water.
Until the little corpses float to the top.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's
and
what I've
done. And you can make sure that you can get rid of them.
For those who are first-time broccoli growers, it can be culture shock.
Well, you two have shared a lot of information in a short time period. I think you need to kind of move to my house and just start the vegetable garden. Our listeners can learn more by visiting ccecolumbiagreen.org/gardening. You can also send questions to us at colgremg@cornell.edu. But for now, let's dig back in. Root crops have a reputation of being able to be stored well. What are some examples, and how should they be harvested?
Okay, the classic beginner root crops are radishes and carrots, which you probably learned to plant when you were a child, or you've gone out with children. They're a wonderful starter crop. Parsnips are sort of a secret crop that more people should try. It's a wonderful soup stock, and they're terrific roasted. Beets are a little more complicated than you should do with children, but they're very easy also. What all of these have in common is they sort of hoist themselves to the surface, and their shoulders will show up above the soil, and you'll say, oh, look, it's almost time to harvest. And then you can dig them carefully with usually a fork, and that's all there is pretty much to them. They store beautifully because they're already oriented to cool, dry places. When you think about it, they've spent their whole life, the part that you're harvesting, underground in a cool, dry place. So you could take those, store them, dry them out a little bit before you store them, and put them somewhere dry. Do not store in contact with each other, because then you've initiated conditions for rot. So just bear that in mind when you're storing them. That goes for all the root crops. Onions, the same thing. Onions are a little trickier. They need to be air dried really before you start storing them anywhere. Potatoes are the magic crop. Most people, if you're growing potatoes, you're growing a field of them, and it's a whole nother thing. So it's not really as much of a home garden thing for a little play garden. So that's a kind of an issue that's beyond us. But they can be stored cold as well and will last you through the winter.
How do you know, like, if something has gone bad? Is there a way for these root crops for you to know if you've stored it too long?
Yeah, usually you can smell it. Seriously, there are distinct scents. So if you're going into a bag of something you've stored, onions have a specific smell. You have to go in, sort them out, get rid of the bad ones, make sure, again, that there's no contact between individuals of that crop. And that's my easy, after the feel as well, of course, because things are going to feel squishy, and you kind of are going to know right away. If you've got something stored away that you haven't been into for a while, and you walk back into that area, if it's a basement or a root cellar or something, you'll know before you get anywhere near the crop. The scents will have told you. That's pretty much it on the root crops.
Well, the nice thing about root crops is some of them are both, because they're cool season crops, they can be planted both in spring and fall. So they're actually quite diverse because of that. The other thing is some of them you can actually use the tops as well as the root. So beets is a good example of that. And it's got lots of vitamins in it, so that's something to consider it. But the real advantage is the fact that, basically you can eat them year-round because of how well they store. Carrots can be difficult depending upon your soil, but they can also be left in the ground for some frost. And as a result, they can also be a little sweeter in that case. Radishes are really, really easy. They grow so quickly. In about 30 days, you can basically have some radish crops, and that's why it's really good for kids as a good starter. Onions require a lot of water. So the key to a good onion crop is making sure you get at least 1.5 inches of water a week, which this was a great year for that. So you've got good onion crops as a result.
And if I were a new gardener just starting out, what do you think is the easiest of these to start with, radishes?
I would go with radishes.
Well, you have to like radishes first.
Well, radishes can be spiralized too. I'm just going to go back on my spiralized obsession.
This is good.
The only thing I grow are tomatoes. What about tomatoes and eggplant? Because they so vary in terms of flavor, and there's so many varieties. What about tomatoes and eggplants?
Yeah, there's so many options when it comes to tomatoes. The key with tomatoes is to understand that the fruit sets optimally when night temperatures are between 58 and 70 degrees. And so sometimes people get frustrated. Why aren't my tomatoes moving along? If it's too cold or if it's too hot, tomatoes are going to stop growing. So if it's over 90 degrees, tomatoes just stop and wait it out. And that can be frustrating. It took forever, it seemed, for the tomatoes to ripen this year. You can wait till they're fully ripe to harvest them, but you can also have them ripen right on your kitchen counter. And the advantage of picking them early is that the critters don't get to them, nor do you, you know, it minimizes diseases from showing up in your tomato crop. Eggplant is same family, but it's a little bit different relative to when you pick it. You wait until the skin is very, very glossy. As soon as it gets dull, it basically is over mature, and you really don't want to take it then. If the seed inside the eggplant is brownish as opposed to white, then it's probably overly mature.
So I think we've come to the end of our segment. Learn
one
more.
One more thing. I just remembered we forgot this other times. Garlic.
Oh,
let's
garlic.
Do garlic briefly before we shut down.
Well, we got to get rid of vampires, so we definitely
yes.
have to do garlic.
Garlic is, again, one of those crops, as being an Italian, it's hard to live without. The key with garlic is to have the plant tell you when it's time to harvest it. So typically the bottom third of the plant is going to turn brown, and then you say, okay, now it's time to start testing. You pull up one or two, make sure you have a very, you know, look at the size of the clump, also look at the size of the head, and make sure the cloves are not separating. If they're starting to separate, you probably should harvest it immediately because that means it could be overly ripe. But you can't use it right away. You basically have to store the whole plant, you know, pull up the whole plant, store it in a well-ventilated room or a screened-in porch or something like that, or lay them on a window screen. You can hang them. Once they dry out after a couple of weeks, then you basically cut the plant to about an inch from the bulb after about 2 to 3 weeks, and then you can store it in any kind of dark, dry, cool location. So they're actually pretty easy to harvest.
Jean, do you think we've now come to the end of our segment?
We have.
So learn more by visiting ccecolumbia.green.org/gardening for more information. You can also send questions to us at colgremg@cornell.edu. I'd like to thank Teresa Golden and Jean Thomas for their insights. Please stay tuned for our second segment on preserving the harvest.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you. Once again, the contact information. Our website is ccecolumbiagreen.org, where you can find more information and links. We're also on Facebook at Master Gardeners of Green and Columbia Counties. You can email the MGVs for specific questions at colgremg@cornell.edu. That's colgremg@cornell.edu. Our next half hour will be a discussion of what to do with the harvest once we've collected it. We're talking to Rebecca Pommetier, Cornell Cooperative Extension's Coordinator for Nutrition, Parenting, and Special Projects. Becky is a certified master food preparer and will guide us through the proper channels to make the most of all our hard work.
So today we have Rebecca Pommetier, who's the Coordinator of Nutrition, Parenting, and Special Projects for Columbia Green Cornell Cooperative Extension. She's also certified as a Master Food Preserver. And while we just talked about harvesting the garden, now we want to talk about preserving the garden harvest. And so, Becky, that's a ton of responsibility that you've got. Today we'll be talking about how to preserve food in different ways. And so why don't we start by what are the types of food preservation that you normally teach?
Well, I do really four main types. We have freezing, which sometimes involves vacuum sealing, dehydrating, canning, and fermentation.
Okay. Becky, what are the biggest dangers? We hear about people eating preserved food and getting sick. What are the main causes?
Well, of course, foodborne illness, especially botulism, is always what people think about when they think about food preservation. So what we always say is if you are following a evidence-based tested recipe and instructions, you should have no worries because they have already figured out kind of the optimum temperatures, length and time to make sure whatever food is being preserved is safe and ready for long-term storage.
So how do you decide which method is best?
It's really dependent on what somebody is most interested in and kind of what they have they would like to preserve. And also even it comes down to things like storage space. So it's really personal what people like. I know that a lot of people enjoy canning because then something's shelf stable so they can easily store it like in a pantry or a closet. Others like freezing because it's a quicker method. But at the same time, you have to actually have the freezer space. And then still others like dehydrating because that's probably the type of food preservation that takes up the least amount of space.
So if you had something like tomatoes, is there a best way to preserve tomatoes?
Not really. Tomatoes are one of those produce items that can be preserved and all the different methods. And again, it's going to be really dependent on what you're interested in, what kind of your space limitations are, your time limitations, and also how you plan on using it. So for example, a tomato that's dehydrated. Some people like to just eat those, but in general, that'd probably be something that'd be really good for like a soup or something where you're going to stick it in a liquid and get it rehydrated. Again, canning is another one that, depending how you want to use it afterwards, that might be the method you really want. So it's really going to be dependent on many factors. So, and it's also interest. I know a lot of people now are getting back into like canning because it's kind of like the oldest method and their grandparents did it. So it's going to come down to a lot of different factors.
Okay, this is Teresa and Jean with the Cornell Cooperative Extension Master Gardeners Digging In program. For those of you who are just tuning in more recently, we're talking to Rebecca Pommettier about preserving food. Becky, where do we get the food to preserve?
Really, you can get it from anywhere as long as it's fresh and recently picked. So we like to say, like, from vine to pot and with and hopefully 24 hours. Realistically, the shortest amount of time you can do that, the better. So if it has to be a little longer past 24 hours, that's fine. But just know that the product you put into the can, the freezer, the dehydrator is the product you're going to get out. So if you're using something that's like not the best, a second, something that you were like, I don't really want to eat this, so I'll preserve it instead, what you're going to get out is a product that's not quite as good. So you can get it out of your own garden's probably best because then you know how long it's been sitting around. Farmers markets, produce stands, pick your own places. All those places are options. I know a lot of the local farm stands around here will let you buy things in bulk. So you can go in and say, I want to can 40 quarts of tomatoes. Can I buy that amount of tomatoes from you? And obviously they will sell them that way. So it's, again, what your preferences are and what is available to you in your area.
Is that's because of a food safety issue or just a vitamin? So it's healthier?
Well, it's more about food quality. So again, it comes down to like, if you want beautiful, you know, county blue ribbon food that or jam, you got to put in the ripest, best looking strawberries. So it's more about quality. When we talk about those types of topics in terms of food safety, one of the ones that really surprises people that we tell them to stay away from is drops. So a lot of people like to take like apples that have dropped off the tree and use that for like apple butter or something along those lines. And we tell people you shouldn't eat, cook, use drops at all because you just do not know in that process of dropping to the ground what could have gotten into them. So that's one of the ones that kind of surprises people. When we talk about food safety, you really have no way of
knowing what's on your produce. So you can go somewhere and it could be the nicest looking produce you've ever seen, but it could still harbor something like botulism or E. coli. So that's why really the method and how you're going about it is the most important. And I think if we talk about food safety, the one that people are most scared about is botulism and canning. And so there's really only two recommended types of canning, which is boil water canning, which is you think about the big like stock pot looking thing that you bring water up to boil and then you put the jars in. And then there's pressure canning. And pressure canning is with a special equipment, a pressure canner, that you bring it under a certain level of pressure for probably a longer period of time. The trick there is knowing that certain produce cannot be boil water canned from a food safety perspective. So it has to go with the acidity in the food. So fruit, for example, is pretty much always safe to put in a boil water canner because fruit is very high in acid. Produce, if you're just going to take your summer squash, for example, and can it, has to be done in a pressure canner because that's where the botulism risk is, actually. What makes people sick from botulism, and I'm kind of going off on that tangent because that's what people think about the most when we talk about canning, is that botulism, the boiled water canning canner is actually the perfect environment for people to get sick with botulism. So it's not botulism itself that makes people sick. It's the spores that are produced when botulism is threatened and kind of goes into this emergency shell they build that releases toxins. And what happens with a boil water canner is it gets right to the optimum temperature that they produce those spores. And also, you're creating a vacuum seal, so an airless, airtight environment, and botulism thrives in an airtight environment. So the pressure canner actually just takes the temperature of the water up even further than what you can get with boiling water alone to a place that's safe, and we know it will kill off the botulism completely and it won't produce those spores. So if we're dealing with, like, I have a vegetable garden and I don't want to worry about pressure canning, what can I do with it? Your real only option is to add acid, also known as pickling. So that's where pickling comes in. Pickling can always be done in a boil water canner because you're adding acid to the food. And the thing about pickling, I tell people, is what that is one of the things that you really do want to make sure you're using a trusted, tested recipe for, and you cannot fool with it because the ratios of salt and vinegar in a canned product is what's making it safe.
Okay, well that's pretty thorough about canning. What are the pitfalls and advantages to the other formats?
So the other formats, what we're really talking about, so the only format that botulism becomes an issue with is actually freezing something that's vacuum sealed. Because with vacuum sealing, you're removing the air, which I just said botulism really loves. And it's safe in the freezer. But when you start bringing it up to temperature by defrosting it, again, you're creating that environment for botulism to produce those spores. So the trick there is that you have to introduce air to the food before you defrost it. In other words, take the package out, slice it so the air gets back in, and then bring it up to temperature in your refrigerator, defrosting it safely, and then it will be safe and you won't have to worry about that.
So if you get into dehydrating, that's a whole nother process, but does that eliminate the risk because of the
dehydrating, freezing, because botulism, it's the spores that you're not producing those because the methods you're using aren't going to produce an environment where you have heat and no air. So those are safe from the botulism perspective. In general, dehydrating is very safe. When we talk about dehydrating, we're really more worried about fungus growth on the dehydrated foods after the fact. What you can do to prevent like mold and that type of growth is actually, believe it or not, freeze things that you've already dehydrated. So you dehydrate and then you freeze. Oh. Wow. Or you got a fruit it's really an issue with because there's a lot of moisture in fruit, so you oftentimes can't get all the liquid out. So we do a process called conditioning, which is you put the fruit in like an airtight container after it's been dehydrated, and you leave it in there for like a week, and you have to like keep going in and shaking it. And if there's a lot of moisture, condensation building up, you know that you did not get all the liquid out of it, so you probably should put it back in to dehydrate further.
So now you've got me terrified about fermentation.
One thing into another. It's nothing really to be terrified of. Like, I always joke, honestly, botulism is really the only one that you hear of those stories from the 1900s where whole families were wiped out. So when we're talking about the other ones, it's more like the foods that you would worry about making you sick in general. So you're taking produce in off of the field. What are the risks there? E. coli, salmonella, all the other scary things. You would just do the same level of what you would do to those vegetables, make them safe to eat right off the vine. You would do the same thing to make them safe to freeze or dehydrate. In terms of fermentation, again, we're really talking about spoilage. And with fermentation, it's more that the product ends up being soggy and kind of gross. So with fermentation, we're talking about making sauerkraut and pickles mostly. And that really has more to do with air temperature. So while you're fermenting, you have to keep the temperature under 78 degrees. And if it gets above 78, that's when the product's going to go bad. So a lot of people try to ferment pickles in the middle of the summer, for example. And then if they don't have central air, their house gets up to like 90 degrees, the product's going to go bad.
And we can find more information on food safety and storage on the Columbia Green website at ccecolumbiagreen.org.
Yes.
What are the pitfalls of freezing?
Freezing doesn't have a lot of pitfalls. I actually say it's one of my favorite ones because it's usually quick, easy, and it doesn't have a lot of the same issues. It's the same things I just said. Whatever you would do from a food safety perspective to eat the food, you do it to freeze it. It has more to do with quality. So some certain foods just don't freeze well, or how you want to use them, it doesn't come out well. So for example, if you're freezing a bunch of berries, when you freeze berries, they produce a liquid. So if you're putting them in a pie or something, that's a great method. If you want to just take them out to eat, that's probably not the way you want to go about trying to preserve them.
So what are the most common questions you get asked about food preservation?
Well, I covered pretty much all the ones I get about canning. I get a lot of questions about which items are safe and okay to freeze. And I can't go into it's an exhaustive list of what is okay and what's not. I would say if anybody has questions, they can give me a call and I would answer that. Like if you have a specific, I have this item, I want to freeze it, is it safe? Give me a call and I do that case by case is a big one.
You mentioned something earlier about tomatoes, that today's tomatoes are different than our grandmother's tomatoes?
Yes, absolutely. So tomatoes are a funny thing. A lot of people think about them as a vegetable, but they're a fruit. So they are high in acid, but they're on the low end of the acid scale when we talk about fruit. So what happens with tomatoes is that if you are preserving them, you have to add a little acid to them to make sure they're safe. And that's it sounds scary when I say add acid, but really that's lemon juice. It's throwing a couple teaspoons of lemon juice in the bottom of whatever container you're using, and then they're going to be safe. And what has happened, because I know I get this a lot, people go, well, my grandmother canned tomatoes her whole life, everything was safe. We've actually bred tomatoes to be less acidic because that's what we like the taste of. So today's tomatoes are not the same as the tomatoes your grandmother ate. And actually, there's absolutely no way for anybody to say this tomato has this much acid in it. It was just not known. They're all grown at different acidity levels now. So tomatoes is kind of a funny thing.
You mentioned something about jellies, too.
Yes, so I get a lot of calls about something failing. So I get people on jam and jelly season call and say, my jam and jelly broke. It's not gelled. What can I do? Well, first of all, after the fact, I makes a really good ice cream sauce. So don't throw it away. You got options. But beforehand, you want to consider what fruit you're using. So when something doesn't gel, it's probably because it doesn't have enough sugar or pectin in it to do it. So certain fruits just will never have enough pectin. Some sometimes have enough. I actually tell people to be safe just to use a commercial pectin. And that way you can pretty much be assured it's going to gel on you. Also, don't mess with the sugar in a recipe either. So people want to be like, I want to make a low sugar jam, which is great, but unless you buy specific pectin that says no sugar, low sugar, it's not going to work. And I also get a lot of questions about jars not sealing and canning. So my jar didn't seal, what do I do? And I always tell people if it's only been like 24 hours, they can either put it in the refrigerator and eat that food right away, or it can actually be reprocessed. So they can put a new top on and put it back in the canner, and then it might seal.
You also mentioned that it's really important to get recipes off a quality from a quality source.
Yes.
What would you recommend?
Well, if you want to do something online, you absolutely can go to our website, Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. You can also Google the National Center for Home Food Preservation is another great resource. And we have links to some other resources on our website. In terms of books, because some people like to just have them right in front, you can be safe with the Ball Blue book that comes out pretty much annually. And also So Easy to Preserve, the 6th edition, is also considered a safe resource to get your recipes from. We will really tell people nowadays to stay away from kind of their grandmother's recipes and their methods, because there's been a lot of evidence and research on what really is the safest and also most delicious ways of doing things. I do get a lot of questions where people will actually say, well, my grandmother did it for years. No one ever got sick. What do I have to worry about? And it's the same with any kind of food if you're just cooking it. Not every cucumber that comes out of the garden has something on it that will make you sick. Most of them won't, but you have no way of knowing. So you can actually improperly do this stuff your whole life and never get sick because you were just lucky. But then if you're one of the unlucky few that pulls in, or there's a E. coli or salmonella outbreak in a field and you use that particular item, now somebody's going to get sick.
How do our listeners learn about or learn more about how to do this safely? Does Cornell offer classes?
Yes, we do. I offer classes. I try to offer them monthly in the food preservation season, which is kind of June through September, October, when produce is coming into season. We do have an upcoming class on pickling on September 27th at 6 o'clock at night at the Hudson office. That's a Friday. And then we might have more upcoming, depending on how that one turns out.
So our listeners can look at, go to ccecolumbiagreene.org and look at upcoming events to find out what else is happening. In addition, they can go to the parenting and nutrition portion of the website, and they'll get additional information about preservation as well as about the food safety and storage.
Yes, and they can also call me. So I am available for like phone consultations if you're in the moment and you need a question answered.
Do you want to give out your phone number?
It is 518-622-9820, extension 117.
Excellent. You've got a lot of other responsibilities besides food preservation. So why don't you talk about some of the other things that you do at Cornell?
I actually am the coordinator for the Parenting, Nutrition, and Special Projects program, and some of our bigger upcoming programs include Parenting with Confidence, which is available in both Columbia and Greene counties, and that's an in-home parenting education program that families can take advantage of. I also offer anger management classes Thursday evenings over in Hudson at 6 o'clock at night. Starting August 22nd is the next round of those. And I also have been doing a series of healthy seasonal cooking classes throughout Greene County. And I am going to be upcoming at both the Coosaquee Library and the Athens Library. So for more information on those classes, since they're at the libraries, I would tell listeners to contact those libraries and ask for more information and to sign up.
Well, Becky, this has been extremely informative. We really thank you for joining us at Digging In with Master Gardeners. And we wish you continued success in educating all the residents of Columbia and Greene Counties about food safety and food preservation, in addition to all the parenting information you provide. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.
You can contact Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties with questions at ccecolumbiagreene.org. Visit us in Hudson or in Accra, or ask us questions on the Master Gardeners of CCE Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook group. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal program and employment opportunities. Someone warm them from below till the rain.